Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Heya, it's the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 232. Come see us in Texas this weekend. Matt, Jonah, and I will be in Houston on Friday night, and then Saturday we're going to drive through the Martian landscape to get to Dallas on Saturday. What's the weather like? Should we bring coats? Coats and scarves and gloves and hats? Matt's pretty adorable in mittens. Say, I'd like to thank our newest sponsor to the Nerdist Podcast, Comixology. I use that app. This is huge news. I read my latest Walking Deads on Comixology. I read the new 52 on Comixology. It's a website, but it's also an app. Listen, if you're enjoying summer blockbusters like The Avengers, The Amazing Spider-Man, you want to treat yourself to the source material. It's the comics. It is a comic-based app. You know all these movies were comics first, right? You knew that. Of course you did. But lately, I've been using Comixology to get all my fix. They have over 25,000 comic books and graphic novels to choose from. So if you're in front of your computer, you're listening to this podcast on your iPad, your iPhone, your Android, your Kindle Fire, you can get a comic and you can read it right now. I mean, my favorite thing to do is you finish one issue and there's immediate instant gratification. Immediate instant. I'll use redundant terms because that's how instantaneously it happens. And for the next 24 hours, Nerdist fans can get two digital comics for free through Comixology. You get Amazing Spider-Man number 648. It's the beginning of one of the most acclaimed runs in Spidey history. It's Dan Slott reinvents Peter Parker's world and sort of presents this new, awesome jumping onto point for the world of Spider-Man. The other one is The Avengers X Sanction number 1, the perfect starting point for fans who love the biggest characters, the Avengers and the X-Men. Not only does this lead into the current Avengers versus X-Men crossover, it's just an awesome self-contained story in one issue. So those are free. They're redeemable on the Comixology website, readable on the entire platform. Go to Comixology.com, Comixology.com/redeem, and enter hashtag Spider-Man, lowercase s, to get the Spidey comic, or hashtag AVX for the Avengers comic. Give the codes to all your friends. Shit, I don't care. Do it. Hand them out. You know, they made these codes with hashtags, so they're super, super easy to remind people. So do it. Get the word out there. It's super fun to read comics on Comixology. It gives you just the cool touch and swipe and gives you the feel of reading a comic book with that panelmation, I call it, where the panels kind of move and enlarge and kind of focus here where you need to focus. Or you don't have to use that if you don't want to. It doesn't necessarily have to work that way on your app. Anyway, go to Comixology.com, sign up, use the codes. All right, this episode of Nerdist Podcast, Greg Proops. Mr. Greg Proops. Joan and Matt were a little indisposed for this episode. Matt got the nerd flu at Comic-Con. He's been down with a sore throat and all fucked up for the last couple days. Jonah Ray decided that at almost age 30, it's a good idea to get his wisdom teeth out, so he was having dental surgery. I still have not had my wisdom teeth out. At this point, I think it's just like, nope. I think I'll just have to settle for crooked teeth and then weird protrusions in the back of my gums because I don't know if I want to have my skull ripped open. It's the kind of thing you should do as a young person. So Greg Proops and I sat down and had a fucking awesome chat. I love Greg. If you haven't listened to his podcast, The Smartest Man in the World, you should. It's available on iTunes. Greg's just a terrific guy with a lot of great information, super smart. And I've been a fan of his ever since Whose Line, when the Wheaton and I used to be roommates, and then every day in the afternoon we'd watch Whose Line on Comedy Central and just fucking love those guys. So it's really cool now to actually be friends with Greg Proops and get to do stand-up with him and stuff. So this was a super fun conversation, the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 232 with Mr. Greg Proops.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
People always ask me what I'm reading, and I think that would be a funny show just to talk about any book that I'm reading that week for a few minutes. And
any book?
Well, I mean, I read a lot of history and baseball and junk like that.
What's your favorite period in history?
Ancient history.
Ancient, like Greek, Roman?
Yeah.
Nice.
Greek, Roman, Egyptian. But right now I'm just reading these two Terry Jones books on medieval history. One was about the Crusades, and one was like called Medieval People. And they're... You know, they're fascinating.
Like Terry Jones?
The Terry Jones.
He
does documentaries in England all the time, history documentaries, and he's quite funny. He's always got his clothes off in them, you know, like there's always a scene in a shower somehow where he manages to get his kid off. And of course, he's just this giant thing, you know. But he's dead funny, and he really knows everything about everything, you know. It's him and another cat named Alan Arriera, and they produced a whole bunch of them. And I've been watching, you know, like Medieval Weapons and all this stuff, but he writes books off the back of them. I found one in the airport in Heathrow called Barbarians. And I read so much ancient history about Romans. And then I found this barbarian book, and it's how they're not barbarians. The Romans were just full of shit and labeled them that way. And like they had really advanced cultures, but the Romans suppressed them and took away all their, you know what I mean? And
usually when people don't believe exactly the same things we believe, they're called barbarians.
Exactly.
And it really comes down to a belief system more than a physical manifestation of their barbarianism.
Right. I mean, not everybody that's a barbarian is walking around with a double-headed axe and a bear hat on, you know, like chopping people up. I mean, they are in the movies. Yeah, like they thought the ancient Greeks were barbarians because they like boys, you know.
Right.
And then the Greeks, of course, invented like things like, oh, I don't know, the steam engine and stuff way before anybody
or
did.
The arch.
Yeah.
What percentage of history that we accept as fact do you think is actually bullshit because of whatever literature survived to document it?
That's a really good question, and I'm always thinking about it because I read the ancients too, and the ancients are lying, right? They're spinning all the time madly, or it's been written 100 years after the fact and they want to cast it in a certain way. I would say maybe almost half.
Right. Because what you really, you know, you sort of take the modern day analogy and then you go, okay, let's for instance say, you know, there's a very limited amounts of text survived from that period.
Yes.
And so much of it was oral tradition, which... You know, I couldn't say something from the one side of this room to the other and have it turn out the same. And so you think about, you know, in 2000 years, if all they had were like transcripts of Rush Limbaugh.
Yes.
And they would be like, well, I guess this was exactly what was going on at the time, is that a lot of times people don't, I don't know what it is, but a lot of times I think people don't view historical documents as editorial.
Right.
They just view them as like, no, these are just black and white facts. It's like, they were written by a guy who had a particular political agenda.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, you're talking about a period of time where religion, science, and politics were all exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were a lot of reasons why the things that he's saying may or may not have been true.
And who gives voice to the poor? Who's a slave writing history? Who's a woman writing history? Who's a child writing history? So they get written out entirely.
Right.
And it focuses on these warrior kings and this and that. Like you're saying, if they only found Rush Limbaugh, what if they just looked at our coins? What, we're obsessed with eagles and we trust in God? And there's, who are these August men with wigs on and shit like that? Like, we're making so many presumptions based on coins and stuff that we find.
That's true.
And, I mean, obviously the context of everything has changed, but people haven't changed that much. There's still the same five things, you know, greed, avarice, conquering, taking, squashing, and
yep.
lying.
Yep. And still every generation says this is the darkest period in history.
Yes, every generation. And they thought the world was going to end a bajillion times, or this is the you know, like the more I read about the Middle Ages and the Enlightenment and the Renaissance and all that, those are all fake names put on them later. When
right.
I was growing up, I thought, oh, when people lived in the Renaissance, they thought, well, it's the Renaissance. Let's just, you know, read some classical Testament.
Like, then I'll play a lute.
Right. And then now the whole new theory is in all these books I read, There was no Renaissance. It's just the end of the Middle Ages, and it had already been going on for 200 years. It's just that they decided to call it that. And then, you know, there's obviously Leonardo. There's lots of leading lights that come popping to the fore.
Sure.
But along with Leonardo is Machiavelli, simultaneous, right? And the Borgias. So, like, Leonardo rolled with the Borgias. He was part of their retinue. But yet he was this gay artist who was a humanist, vegetarian, and he liked women, and he had an insane world that he lived in, too, of engineering and all that jazz. But, of course, he made military machines or designed them for the war machine because that's how you had a gig.
Yeah.
So clearly, and it's not written anywhere, he knew Machiavelli because if he was in the same group,
sure,
you know, I mean, they don't, like, we don't have video of them now. Now we would have video. Well, we don't have it now, right? I mean, we just went through the giantest war ever. And there's always that one picture they show of Dick Cheney with Saddam Hussein from like 1974 when they're shaking
hands. Right,
right. But clearly there were many more meetings.
It didn't just go from that to...
Yeah, we make enemies out of people.
It's sort of like, you know, they're in a certain stratum. They're probably going to know each other. It's like, hey, you know... You know Louis C.K. and Marc Maron, yeah. And like these are comics who, you know, like you know people in your field or people in your general area of study, even if whether or not we know them well, it's like, well, particularly in those days, their paths probably would have crossed at some point.
In a much smaller world, yeah. A more rarefied atmosphere.
Explain the Dark Ages to me. Was this 800 to 1300? Was that? Am I getting the dates
they
right?
They keep moving the goalposts on it, but yeah, like sort of vaguely in there. A lot of times it goes from the end of the Roman Empire or the end of the Western Roman Empire, so in like the late 400s, early 500s. And it's dark in so much as a bunch of knowledge is lost. And then, because in the... Obviously, the Romans had mad engineering, and they bathed. And there's a book by Boris Johnson, who's the mayor of London, who's a right old fascist, but quite a decent historian. And he wrote this book about how the EU is analogous to the Roman Empire. And the thing he kept fixating on through the Dark Ages was, you don't find scissors. He goes, there's no more tweezers and scissors. Everyone was so hairy. And he's like, in the Roman days, you were shaved clean, and you went to the bath every day if you had any money at all. Even poor people went to the bath every day because you could go for like one sesterce or whatever it was. And,
sure.
And Arabs have always had baths. Like if you go to the Arab world, you know there's always a hammam everywhere, mm-hmm. a communal one where people go, men on one side, women on the other. And bathing sort of got lost in the Dark Ages, right? But the idea that there wasn't science or that there wasn't technology.
Just no real advancements of any kind. Is it possible that... That did happen and we just don't know? Or is it there would have been some indicators at some point?
I think there was science and technology. I just think it moved a lot slower. And I think because of the lack of good roads, the other thing the Romans did, aside from dominate the world with their enormous cock, was build roads everywhere. They had to get their army from one place to the other. So the entirety of Europe and the Middle East and Africa was connected by roads. And they were brilliant at bringing water in. So they always had aqueducts. You've been to Europe and seen aqueducts that are still standing from 2,000 years ago.
Yep.
And the engineering is fabulous. All they did was grade it so that it went down a few inches every couple of kilometers or whatever, so that the pressure of the water finds its own pressure. They were aware of that. If you find a lake that's way up high and you have a high village on a hill, you can make water come to that hill with an aqueduct.
Yeah.
You don't need pumps and electricity and computers and all that jazz.
You can use gravity.
Use gravity.
I think, I do think it's interesting though. Because we take for granted now, like we have basically several iterations of Moore's law, and so we assume that, you know, that we're on this constant, never ending path of advancement.
Right.
And you know, when you think about how pissed off, how excited people get every year a new iPhone comes out, and then if Apple or whatever company doesn't reinvent the industry every year, people get mad and frustrated. No, it's all boring now. It's like, do you realize there were periods where centuries of nothing happened?
Yeah.
People ate, they shit, they fucked, and that was it.
Yeah.
That it was nothing, nothing
for no printing press.
hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yeah. No media. Entertainment was someone who came to your town and juggled.
us.
Right, or us. Yeah, no, I know that the pressing to go forward all the time, and also the presumption that somehow it was different, you know, that I've lost my train of thought here. But yeah, I agree with you. Say there's this built-in obsolescence of everything now. There has to be a new phone, there has to be a new computer, there has to be a new this, how new that. we couldn't build the pyramids.
No.
You know what I mean?
I just saw a video that theorized on how they moved the stone heads on Easter Island.
Yes.
National
Geographic.
Yeah, National Geographic, right. Where they just used like 8 ropes,
yeah,
and then they just wobbled the thing into place.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Right. It wasn't like you think, well, they didn't have the wheel and all the technology we have. First of all, can you imagine us building those giant heads and moving them to the most remote island in the universe and then moving them up to a hill? Some of them had hats on, too. And they put the hats on them, too. I mean, I love the idea that the ancient world is a more primitive world,
mm-hmm,
because it's completely false. They had philosophy. They had theosophy. They had belief systems. They had mathematics. They weren't ignorant people who looked and went, the world is flat and the sun is on.
And they also had to solve bigger problems with less resources.
Yeah. But they also had all day to do it because they weren't distracted by looking at their phone every 2 seconds. And if you were someone who followed the stars, that's what you did.
Yeah.
So you knew retrograde motion. You knew all the planets. You couldn't see all of them. You couldn't see, you know, Uranus and Pluto. But all the ones visible to the eye, they knew the difference between Jupiter and a star. And the circumference of the world was figured out 2,500, 3,000 years ago. Everybody already knew. And no one ever believed the world was flat. That's just a plain, straight-up fucking lie that's ripped from literature.
Really?
Washington Irving wrote a story about Columbus 170 years ago where he said Columbus went to the court and all the people were mad at him, all the viziers and whatnot. No, the world's flat. You'll fall off. And, like, they didn't believe that then. What Columbus believed was the world was way smaller than it was. And that he would be able to get all the way to Asia from Europe. I'll be back in 2 months.
Right.
Just, like, give me the money and I'll come back. Magellan, too. Like, they underestimated how small the world was. They didn't think it was flat and you'd fall off. Now, along with that, when you got out in uncharted water, yeah, the sailors thought there'd be dragons. You know what
sure,
I mean?
Sure, like, of course.
There was a healthy dose of what do you call it? Oh my God.
Mythology?
Lucky on the word. You bad luck. Superstition.
Yeah.
But I'm superstitious. You know, so I don't think superstition ever went away.
And by the way, we still don't know everything that's on the ocean floor.
No.
With the technology that we have, we still don't know everything that's down there.
Did you see the fish a couple of months ago? I was listening to some interview on the radio where the guy's talking about they found dozens of new species and their minds were blown at the fish they found down there. And we don't know anything about anything is what I'm getting. I was in Turkey with my wife years ago, and we were walking up to this thing called the Chimera, which is a bunch of gas shooting out of the ground in different flames, right? It looks like an oven, like those blue flames.
Sure.
And they make a noise. And, it's a rocky field, and there's dozens of them. And they said thousands of years ago, they were even higher. They're about this high now, like 3-4 feet high. In the days of the Iliad and whatnot, they were 6 feet high, and you can see them because you can see the sea. And so, of course, they thought that's where Vulcan's Forge was. Hephaestus' Forge.
Oh, of course.
Underneath there. But then on the way up this hill, which is marked with rocks, like talk about the descent of man.
Yeah.
Like there's a crappy path to this, and there's rocks sort of pointing the way. There's Lycian temples that are buried in the underbrush. And you're like, those temples are 15,000 years old.
Oh, my God.
And so they just don't have the money to dig them out. It's Turkey. You know, they have other pressing concerns like, you know, wiping out Kurds and shit. So they don't have time to
stop and dig out the temple.
I mean, they dig, and the other new theory or new earth theory is, of course, you know, they came up with that people walked across the land bridge and that's why we have sure. Indians and shit like that. And the coasts are different than they were 15, 20, 30,000 years ago. So we had more land that went up further.
Yeah.
So that part's buried and we don't know what's under it. And why couldn't people from other countries have taken boats here?
Right.
We insist that they fucking walked. And they walked all the way from Siberia and then all the way down to fucking Tierra del Fuego. And it's like, they had boat technology. This
right.
isn't like out of the realm of man. I mean, why presume that people 20,000 years ago walked around and just stared at each other? They obviously had languages and, you know, when you see, where are you from originally?
I was born in Kentucky and I grew up in Memphis.
Well, then you know those giant mounds in the south
yeah.
where the Indians lived. Those were metropolises where they had fish farms and raised corn and bred corn.
Yeah.
So that the reason why the corn is edible is the Indians did that 15,000 years ago. We didn't do that. They
right.
made corn edible. They found it. They bred it. They carried on doing, You know, so when you see those mounds in Alabama and those places like that, those were giant cities in North America that we just go, oh, the Indians, they're all drunk and they just want a truck. And
maybe they're just mad that we took all their shit.
Kind of mad.
I mean, it's basically the equivalent of the guy who, like, you know, he trusts a girl and then she fucks him over and then he just sits in a bar. He's like, God, fucking bitch.
Yeah.
That fucking bitch, man. I trusted her. That's basically that's the relationship that happened.
Pretty much horribly. The abusive relationship.
You know, the one thing shocking to me that I've now that we're talking about this, that I don't actually know is I know that agriculture had a lot to do with, you know, what sort of spawned modern man, sort of Homo sapiens sapien, but what was there kind of a defining moment? I know it was around 10-20,000 years ago, but I don't know what it was specifically that got us essentially, you know, out of the forests and into the earth and building farms and societies and then a sort of, you know, a modern representation of what man is.
Right. Well, if you saw the movie 10,000 BC, you know that mammoths helped build the pyramid.
They did.
And they were very helpful. And then they'd get scared and they'd run down the pyramid.
Sure.
And then there were several different kinds of tribes. There was the bald-headed tribe.
Yep.
And then the tribe that spoke cave English.
You know, that's right.
Oh,
Yes.
You know, like we're...
Yeah, so that's my basic understanding of how it all...
I love movies like that. I think they lowball everything. And to make ourselves feel good, I think historians go, it was only 10,000 years ago that written word. It's like, people were communicating way before that. If people are 3 million years old, if, you know, hominids or whatever,
sure.
If we go back that far, then no fucking way was it only 10,000 years ago. But I think there's a defining moment where when people started to grow things, that made agriculture. Agriculture makes leisure because then you have excess.
Sure.
And as soon as you have more food than you need to feed the people around you, then you can build a city. And a city is the beginning of civilization because then a city means specialization. Now you make pottery, I make clothes, they make shoes, you make swords. Now we're not doing jobs that require us going out and hunting and gathering all day. That's the defining moment when people become people. And then within that becomes... Now we need entertainment. Someone's got to read to us. Someone's got to write a fucking story. Someone's got to... I mean, when you find those first tablets of cuneiform from, like, Iraq from 10,000 years ago, they're bills of sale. 5,000 sheaves of corn, this much barley, this many mules, those, you know, those intense ones with that have the stylus and everything. Commerce is the first thing, I think, that got... As soon as they had enough stuff to sell, people went... Let's do that.
Yeah.
Let's take a boat and we'll go up the river. I know they don't have anything over there.
Yep.
Or let's go across the Mediterranean. And then, you know, Egypt and what Americans hate to think about, the Middle East that we incessantly bomb and invade is the heart of civilization for white people.
The Tigris and Euphrates River, like the Fertile Crescent. And it's sort of, I that's a fun idea though of... You know, of getting to a point where people are like, you know, I don't feel like hunting or gathering, but I still want food. Maybe I could just give you something that would then give me some of the extra food that you have. Yeah. Maybe there's some service that I could provide you. Like, there's just like this kind of social bartering that exists.
Oh, absolutely. And then money is a real concept then because it's whatever coins or whatever they start with, wooden blocks, and then move into coins. And then paper, when the Chinese had paper way before we did. But now money's an elusive, ephemeral, made-up bullshit concept.
Sure.
People go, oh, well, we can run out of money, or this bank ran out of money, or whatever. And it's like, there's no finite amount of money. Money's an idea now.
Yeah.
Money lives in a machine. We don't have enough gold in the world to back up a currency. There's only a finite amount of gold in the world.
Right.
The amount of gold in the world now is the same amount of gold in the world that was 1,000 years ago. Like, they're not digging it up every 2 seconds and adding to the... You know what I mean? Like, the idea that Fort Knox or the Federal Reserve, boy, there's some fucking hard, you know...
I always think when I, you know, when I go, you know, like if I check my statement online and I just go, okay, that is a digital representation of theoretically what I have. I don't really possess that in a physical sense. It's just, if I wanted to, there's a good chance I could just go take that out, but... There's not really any, you know, it's really just this sort of agreed upon concept.
It's an illusion that we all sort of simultaneously have decided to hold together. And So say you wanted the physical version. Say I want $25,000 out of my bank. Then they give you a stack of money or a piece of paper that represents that. So it's even more of a metaphor. Once you finally see it, money isn't valuable. It's printed with numbers on it. They are the same piece of paper over and over again. Like, you know, you can imagine a gold coin and a silver coin have different value because of what they're made of.
Sure.
But what we deal with now is like a... And the idea that, oh, so the ancient people are primitive because they put coins in a bucket. It's like, they didn't pretend.
Those were precious metals that were hard to find, and that's why they had value.
I mean, when you hear about banks go broke, or what was it, J.P. Morgan lost $2 billion like 2 months ago, and then they went, you know, they're like, where is it? What is it? Where did it go? Whose was it? You know, it's just this big swirling mass.
I mean, I guess I don't fully understand all that. I just, in my head, I just go, well, I guess it just vanished. But it obviously it had to go somewhere. When people lose money in the stock market, someone else is winning money somewhere.
Yes.
Because it's, I mean, you know, in the sense, it falls under the same, I think, the same definition of conservation of energy.
Right.
Where it's like, it's not created, it's not destroyed, it's redistributed. So it's where is it redistributed?
Yeah, where did it go? Yeah, that's just, to me, that's the big lie of our time. You know, all the money gets spent on, not that they wouldn't have done it then. That's the other thing, I think. If the Romans had been able to have nuclear warheads and TV and spin propaganda and the internet, they'd have loved it.
Of course they would have.
They wouldn't have waited 1 second to use it for evil purposes like we do now.
No. They were, you know, I mean, I know they loved science and philosophy and whatnot, but they were just as egocentric. I mean, like, you have to have a certain amount of narcissism to think, you know, that we're grand enough to deserve those things and to celebrate ourselves, you know.
And to control an empire and make one language, one law, blah, 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 blah. And when Marco Polo went to China in the 1200s, he saw eyeglasses, people using coal for fuel, and paper money, and people were writing checks. And he'd never seen a check in his life. He's from a merchant family. And by the way, he spoke Chinese and Mongol because his uncle and his father did. They was making like he just wandered over there. His father and his uncle had been there, came back and got him when he was a teenager, took him back over, and he lived there for 20 years.
Oh, wow.
Well, Kublai Khan made him a tax collector, so he went all around, down to Vietnam, Java, everywhere, all across China. And everything he saw blew his fucking mind. He'd never had food that had different subtle flavors. He'd never seen anyone write a check while wearing glasses. Go, you can cash this 5,000 miles from here because we all agreed. Because Europe was still, you know, they weren't as advanced. And then when he came back and told everybody what he saw, which he did in his book, they called him Il Milione in Venice, the million lies.
Oh, that sucks. No, I swear to God, you guys. I swear.
I saw fireworks that lasted all night from a pleasure boat full of women on it in the middle of a man-made lake with everyone wearing silk.
Whatever, hippie.
Yeah, exactly.
Get the fuck out of here.
Dude. Nobody has that shit, and nobody ever will.
I wonder what the... I wonder what the origin of comedy was. Like you said, obviously when people have free time, they have leisure time, they need entertainment.
Yeah.
So, you know, I always have this idea that laughter is really a very tribal thing that happens in a group of people where you can point out some things that they all recognize and collectively, they collectively, I guess, recognize is the right word. And so in doing that, their laughter is sort of an expression of, I am safe. I am with my people and I'm not going to die.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think the first gag is someone hitting someone else in the head with a stick and everybody's standing around and the guy didn't see it coming, you know, or he fell in, you know, someone tripped someone and everybody goes, you know.
Yeah.
But there is that safety, that tribal thing. Humor doesn't exist on its own. I mean, obviously you can laugh on your own, but as soon as you add an audience, then one person is the focus of it, I think. I mean, by the Middle Ages, it's sophisticated because you have to have a jester. As well as people who go from town to town. And then there's balladeers who write the song of you. Just like in Monty Python's
Brave Sir Robin. Yes.
Fucking, they had guys who wrote songs about them, who followed them around and shit like that. And it's just true.
How powerful were the court jesters?
I think they were able to get away with saying things that other people couldn't say. Like if you were in the court and you were a count or a duke or something, I don't think you could go, you're fat and you're ugly. you have rotten teeth and your wife's a whore.
Right.
Without getting your head chopped off. But I think the jester could come out and do it, and the king would be like, oh, oh, this guy. It's sort of like Rickles with Sinatra.
Of course.
You know, like, I remember Ed Krasnick telling me a story. He was in the dressing room with Sinatra and, with Rickles. And he said Rickles would call Sinatra on the phone and go, shut up, Frank. And Frank on the phone, he could hear him, would go, everybody, he just told me to shut up. Like, no one speaks to the Pope that way, you know?
But there's always one guy that's allowed to.
Yeah. This guy, because he's harmless or he's whatever position he holds. I mean, to take it even to a metaphorical level or whatever, we're jesters, right?
Sure, of course.
We make fun of whatever field we're making fun of, and we're allowed to do that. You can throw darts at the elephant, and that's why we have political comedy. That's why we have social comedy. That's why there's comedy that's a parody of other media and other comedy. And
well, to a degree, we do. You know, but what I'm noticing lately, though, is because I feel like, you know, obviously we don't have. There's obviously no legal censorship, to a degree, but
on TV.
but I feel like there's a tremendous amount of social censorship now of people being offended or outraged by things, and that, which I think, you know, in a sense makes them feel superior when they can go, you're not allowed to say that. Yeah. And it's like, and you know, I mean, it's dicey because I've said a million times before, you know, you either. Inside all comedy, for the most part, is the seed of something that is offensive to someone.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is our job, is to take things that are uncomfortable and deal with them and express them and try to make them safe and manageable for everyone. And so, you know, the person who is offended by, a joke you made about, like, hey, that guy made a joke about punching a baby. That offends me. Right. Or like, yeah, but you just laughed at the joke about the fat guy. But you didn't mind that hurt that guy's feelings. No. You know, so it's like people just only care about what directly affects them. And then they want to tell comics what they can and can't say. And I think it's a very interesting time for us that I feel like we are way not as enlightened as we used to be. We have not really moved forward, I don't think, in some senses.
I said it to Overton. Overton said it to me. We were talking about this very thing, and he said, hip used to mean that you had a broad range of taste, not that you thought this many things, and things on the outside of that weren't hip.
Right.
Like, you go, on top of what you're saying, where everybody feels empowered in their own subjectivity, which I find every night at the club, I'll go on after and I'll tell a joke and everyone will go, ooh, and I'll go, remember before, during the fat bitch fisting joke, how your head was thrown back in laughter, and now I've come on with a Kardashian joke and I'm a fucking evil wizard or
yeah,
whatever.
I know, it's really interesting.
And on top of that, there's political correctness that's observed, and then there's unpolitical correctness that's observed, depending on where you are.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like, you go to a rough and ready room, and they're ready for they're ready for anything.
Yeah.
I find that working class people don't carry the same precepts that bourgeois people. Bourgeois people go, oh, we can't laugh at the Obama joke because that'll mean that there's all these indicators and signifiers that they're trying to observe all the time.
Yeah.
Whereas people who fucking work all day lifting parts out of a thing and putting them in another thing and then they get drunk at night are like, fuck it.
Yeah. That's,
I want to laugh.
That's funny you say that. I mean, I you know, I had this joke in my act about like why it's like, oh, it's important to have kids young, you know, are there Latinos here? And then a few people clap and I go, you guys do it right. You have your three or four kids and then you slow down so you can enjoy your late teens. And and the Latino crowds laugh because they know that I'm not really attacking them.
Yeah.
The only time it's ever gotten ooze was when there was in all white faces in the crowd. Yeah. And they're like, whoa, oh, you can't.
You're saying that they're having unprepared birth.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like, you know, which to me is more arrogant than what they're accusing me of.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Comedy, it's tricky. It's tricky, especially with the internet, where everything can be taken out of context, dissected, people who weren't there then commenting on it.
Right.
It's like comedy is a live medium, and you know, if you took the transcript of any comic's act, almost any comics act, if you looked at their transcript, you'd be like, this guy's a fucking asshole,
right,
you know?
Right.
But in the spirit of the room, it's just not, you know, like, it's a safe zone. And once you're out of that safe zone, people don't understand anymore. Oh, yeah. So they shouldn't be allowed to comment on shit they weren't present for.
I think we'd be so far past this because that exact thing happened to Lenny Bruce, right? They transcribed his act, and then a policeman read it in court, and he begged to be able to read it himself. And went, please let me read it.
Right.
So that you'll see how this goes instead
right.
of... Then the bitch went to the cocksucker. Like, you know, you as soon as someone else is reading...
Sounds like the manifesto of a serial killer.
It's just terrible. And you think, what did Carlin say? Within the right context and with the right wording, everything's funny. Or anything's funny.
Sure.
There's always a victim. There's always a victim. Even someone slipping on a banana peel. That guy might have hurt himself, but you don't care at the moment.
Right.
But then people always want to protect their corner and go, you mustn't say this about this group and you mustn't say that about that group. Having said that, we all realize there's rich people, poor people, there's women, there's men. And
yeah.
There's huge context that goes to every, you know.
Yeah.
Some words are absolutely fucking verboten.
Yeah.
And other words aren't. I mean, you can call people bitches and you don't get slammed. If you're on the internet, if you say the N-bomb, and
yeah.
I'm being childish by saying it,
yeah.
That's just verboten. Or the sea dog.
The sea dog.
That one just stops shit dead. Of course, if you go to England and you
then it's not,
hilarious.
Then it doesn't, yeah.
So...
Yeah, we were talking with John Barrowman on the podcast a couple nights ago about like what the rules are for being able to say cunt on British television late at night.
Right.
And it's like, you can say it, but you have to submit forms and there has to be a reason. I mean, you know, because you've worked, you know, you're sort of a comedy expat, wouldn't you say? Like you have your feet in both cultures. Pretty squarely.
I was just there for a couple of weeks. I was just in Dublin in England and did a bunch of shows. And speaking of, I got a dude that like heckled the shit out of me. I was playing this tent called the Utterbelly on the river in London. And it's a tent, right? So, you know, you're really a clown. Flat floor, raked house. So it's too bright. You know, so I'm standing there on the floor. You're not above them. You're not on a stage, per se. You're in an arena. And this dude was just fucking me off. And he was heckling me. And he was, you know, giving me the, oh, you're kind of a faggot or whatever thing.
Yeah.
And I went over to him. And I kind of lost my shit, which I'm not that proud of. But he deserved it. And I go, listen, mate. I go, I have a huge ego. I want you to go. And I took out a 20-pound note.
Yeah.
And I said... fuck straight off out of here. Here's your money back. So he took it because he was going to prove a point. He was with his girlfriend or wife. He split, and I'm not kidding, three beats later came back in and went, handed me back the 20 and went, she locked it. And I mean, the places people were throwing shit at him, like, it's England, so all of a sudden glasses are starting to fly.
That's such a great moment. I mean, like, the heckler duel, which I know the British crowds love to see that more than, you know, we get a little more uncomfortable sometimes in the States, and we're told to keep quiet in audiences, and that's fine. I mean, there is a sport in it, and as a comic who likes to kind of, you know, keep every set fresh, it's sort of fun to talk to people in the audience fuck around. But every once in a while, there is that one guy, and at a certain point when they don't stop, it is really fun to sort of take a step back and just let and they don't know that it's going to happen, but you know, one more sentence and the audience will hate you because they didn't pay to see you, and you're tanking their experience.
Yeah.
And all I have to do is just let you continue to be you, and you're done. That's so gratifying to me when that happens, when you can actually get the crowd to turn and just implode on the guy who will not fucking shut
they
up.
Will. The skill is to not hammer on them so hard that the audience feels like they're on his team.
Right.
Because that happens, right? That's the opposite of it. You go, hey, you fucking blah, 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 blah. And then they kind of go, hey, hey, hey.
Yeah.
He's just a drunk.
Yeah.
Instead of when you, like you say, let them detonate.
It is a really, it's such a fine line. And I wouldn't even know how to tell someone, how to do it other than just, you just have to be in that situation a lot to feel it. It's so like Kung Fu with the blindfold.
Yeah.
Like it's you just kind of feel. What is it about us, do you think, that How do we get that awareness of a room? Like, you know what I mean? Like that sort of that Spider-Man time thing where you're just hyper aware of every inch of the room and like what the energy of each section is and what's how it's going to, you know, it does. I mean, it doesn't happen all the time, but it, when you kind of get into a role, then you just are like, and you just you could just feel the room.
Absolutely. I say that to the crowd. I'll go, by the way, I'm Jedi, and I know what each of you are doing on each show. And I can tell those people back there aren't reacting right now. Or you see people looking down or they're all of a sudden the glow of the phone or whatever. And like, it's just a thing. It's a spider sense you develop over time where you really can feel a whole room. Not only that, and I don't know if this happens to you, I can count a room. I can count how many people are there, and I'm terrible at math.
No, I can't do that.
At the end of the night, I'll walk out and go, what was there, about 180 people? And they go, yeah, there's 193. And it's just a sense. Like, I can't count. I'm not counting.
It's something that I think it's fun to watch. Like, it's almost like when a young comic starts, or like a mutant kind of starts figuring out their power, but they don't know how to control it yet. But young, I see young comics do this all the time. Obviously, we have a natural drive because we want everyone in the room to like us to zero in on the person or a couple people who aren't into the show.
Yeah.
And so sometimes it's better just to leave them alone. Like no one else will notice them if I don't bring it up.
Right.
But the young comics who start to develop that sense and then all of a sudden notice those people, then bring it to everyone's attention. It's like, oh, you just killed the room because they didn't, no one else knew.
Yeah.
And it's trying to figure out how to know like when to call attention to it and when to know, yeah, if I don't bring it up, no one's going
to
give a shit.
Isn't that weird? That's such a... Because it happens to me every night. There'll always be someone in the front or second row or the second table.
Here, come a little closer to the mic.
And they're just... Yeah, and they're just bored. Eye rolling, yawning.
Why did you come out tonight?
Right, and you're like, what the fuck? And couldn't you have sat in the back?
Yeah.
If you sat in the back, I wouldn't have been able to actually see you physically.
Yeah.
Be bored with my ass. And then for me, it's always a matter of do I attack them or leave them alone? And like you say, discretion, discretion, discretion. I was playing like Newbury in England or something. And I remember calling my wife, this is before cell phones, like on a pay phone after the show. And she goes, how was the show tonight? And I go, they were douchebags and I ripped them a new asshole. And she goes, well, that must have made you feel good. And I hung up the phone and I was like, God damn it, she's right. That was what frustrated me.
Well, I know, but that's, you know, I mean, even from the earliest days of me actually, I mean, obviously I've known who you are and been a fan of yours since, you know, the Who's Line days. But the first time I got to start seeing you do live comedy, there was a certain thing that I noticed you would do, and I always was like, oh man, I would love to be that confident on stage, which is I would see you, I feel like, say some things that you knew were going to go over the audience's head so that they could challenge you or not get it so that then you could just fucking go after them. And it was so much fun. It was so much fun to watch because as a young comic who was kind of afraid in the beginning of audiences, it was the polar opposite of like, not only are you not afraid of an audience, you are daring them to challenge you so that you can try to fuck them up. And to me, that was just like the ultimate power in a room.
That's very nice of you to say. I probably still do it a little bit. Weinhold once said, I tell one joke and then I spend 10 minutes telling the audience why they were too stupid to get the joke. But I will go after, although I didn't do it last weekend, I will go after crowds. If they're not giving me what I want, I go after them. And I will cock slap them until they come around to my way. And they usually like it, which is what's weird.
So who do you think comedy is for? Do you think it's for the audience or do you think it's for the performer? Or is it just for both of us?
Well, it's for both of us. I mean, I do it for myself. Someone asked me the other day, do you try to tailor material so that the audience will like it? It wasn't in a stand-up context. It was in some other like comedy thing. Do you try to write material so they get it? And I was like, no, you can't. With my podcast, do you tailor your podcast to make sure the audience gets it?
Sure.
It's like, no, I talk about the obscure shit. I mean, you're the biggest example in the world of, you didn't take something that everyone likes. You took what you liked.
Sure.
And you made it into a thing.
Well, that's the ultimate goal of a stand-up, I think, is to, you know, it's just that Bill Hicks thing of like, however he said it, but, you know, the more you are, the less competition you have.
Yeah. You've already got a product. You.
Yeah.
You don't have to be like all the other ones. And I've felt like as a stand-up, I'm in the same field as a million other people. But then when I started doing the podcast, and it's sort of evolved over the last couple of years, the more obscure I make it, the more I make it about what I like to talk about. Mm-hmm. And the more I ignore utterly what television or any other media would demand of stand-up, the more people have responded to me personally.
Well, I think there's something inherently fun about, even if you don't get exactly what someone's talking about, there's an energy that you pick up on when you know that someone cares a shitload about what they're saying and they know what they're talking about. Even if you don't understand the material, yeah. it's still interesting and fun to watch.
I agree. I think people watch the old British Who's line, and you know how Americans are. Anything that's even vaguely foreign, they like lose their shit entirely.
Sure.
Like if they hear the word Twiglet or John Major or something, they'll be like, but what's John Major? And it's like, he's a prime minister. What's a prime minister?
You right.
Like, but I think it was fun for them. Like people, I think part of the excitement of it was they go like, man, I couldn't figure half that stuff out, but it was great, you know?
Well, yes, but I mean, obviously there were references that I didn't get when I was, and then there was no internet at the time to rush over and be like, who is that person?
No, there wasn't.
There was an internet, but it was still, I think, relatively DARPA based and it wasn't really, but I remember still responding to the fact that the crowd there fucking ate it up. Mm. So I was like, oh, okay, I don't know what that is. But it's obviously a thing because everyone else gets it.
Why is everyone laughing at a Torval and Dean reference? And they're like, who the fuck are... Even when I was there, I didn't get things. And even now when I play there, I'll go to the comedy store or whatever, and we'll be doing improv, and they'll yell shit out that's just completely, I don't know what you're talking about. That's some sort of 60s or 70s English shit that you guys all know that I don't know.
Yeah.
And they also have way more of a collective memory. Like they, hilariously, well, since we were just interrupted by English people... They all use the same phrases, and Americans do, kind of, but not as much as English people. Like, they'll say, at the end of the day, or easy peasy lemon squeezy,
sure.
Or I'm chuffed, or tiggity boo.
Right.
And, like, everybody knows what it means, and, like, here, there is still, we're so big,
it's just
still more regional things, and more, like, you know, that country... And in Australia, too, I find, like, they really do, they lean on catchphrases to help, you know, the lubricity of socializing is, if you go to Oz, and I'm sure you've been, it is good day, mate, and good bless.
Well, yeah, because there's only, like 18 million, million of them.
Right, and the continent's vast, and there's 12 of them.
And mostly uninhabitable.
Yes, and wildly uninhabitable, like just lizards spitting poison.
Puffs of
vile things that if you touch, like, your skin crisps.
Carnivorous birds.
Yeah,
and
it really is
fucking
wild.
Baby-sized spiders. And,
you know,
it's just there are coastal people that thrive on the coast, and then they just, you know, going inland sucks. You know, you don't go to Alice Springs. I've been to, I've been to Brisbane and Melbourne and Sydney and, you know, just kind of around that, you know, Queensland.
Me too.
Queensland, Brisbane.
But I've never been in the interior. Flown over it.
I've never been to Perth.
Never been to Perth.
Or Tasmania.
Oh, I did go to Perth on the last trip. I've never been to Darwin, which is way the fuck up there. Perth was better than I thought. I really enjoyed Perth. And also, Bon Scott is from Perth and is buried there. So we were very excited by that. Perth is deeply Asian. It's because it's closer. It's on the other side. And, like, there were so many Chinese people there. And all of the, another way when you go to different places around the world, like you're in California, the people who cook the food are Mexicans. In Los Angeles, the people who drive the cabs are Russians and Armenians.
Mm-hmm.
You go to Australia, the people who drive the cabs are South Africans. You know, like, there's always a Bracero program.
Sure,
where people are brought in from another country. And then you go to London sometimes, and you get in a cab. And where are you from? I'm from Bulgaria. What do you do there? I'm an engineer. I'm smarter than everyone who gets in this fucking cab.
Yeah.
It's just that I'm here and I can't.
I can't do what I was trained to do.
In Australia, too, so people say, like, people come from Indonesia and, like, what, you meet an Indonesian cab driver. What do you do in Indonesia? I'm a physician.
Yeah.
When, what are you doing here? I'm driving you around.
Could you
asshole.
Please just pretend to choke on something so I could try to practice the thing that I was trained to do? Because this isn't it.
That's all economics. But, I don't know. They, the fun part of doing all that travel is trying to communicate with people in every, well, Anglophone people. Let's be honest. I'm not trading in any other language right now. But I did the podcast in Australia and I did the podcast in New Zealand. I talked about them to some extent, and then I talked about the shit I wanted to talk about. But I think they like it too. You know, there is a slight inferiority thing with Australians and Kiwis because they're not close to us physically, and or England, which is the motherland for them. We're not the motherland for them in any way, other than sort of the media, kind of. They're much more influenced by England, and I always think they do because the English people treat them that way, one, but also, two, they feel a little... They like to be recognized.
Well, and then also
as a culture.
Personally, I don't think they should still have the law of prima nocte. I mean, I don't think it's. I don't support it. It's. I think that really has had a lot of.
For them. It just makes them feel good. Makes them happy, Chris. What are you gonna,
for the queen, lunge.
Yeah. Otherwise, the prime minister in Australia a few years ago when the queen went down there, patted her on the back. He gave her a good old clap on the back. And you're not supposed to even touch her. But it was like Australia's LA, man.
Oh, yeah, just give you a good pat on the back there.
Yeah.
Oh, you all right?
Yeah.
Oh, get up there off the floor.
Yeah, right.
Oh.
Hand that a Victoria beer. Yeah, they're right.
VB, have a bit of VB.
Yeah, VB.
Yeah, when I was in Australia last time, I was still in boozy Hardwick, so it was like VB and Crown Lager you know, all these great beers, and they don't drink Foster's.
No, they don't drink it at all. They think it's a joke. That is always amusing.
But they do love Bloomin' Onions, I'll tell you.
Yeah, they do, man. They'll love a Bloomin' Onion on you. And they'll eat, what do they call them, bugs? They're like the little crayfish.
Oh yeah,
something bay bugs. I can't remember the name.
Damn it!
I know
what you're talking about.
The crowd will have to go Google it.
They will.
Bugs. They eat bugs. Yeah, they do.
I've never performed in Australia though. I feel like, you know, so much of my
this would kill there. The whole, you know, the game culture.
We should go do some pot. You know, it's just the economics of it. I mean, it's hard. It's hard. You know, it's your podcast is essentially you. My podcast is me and Matt and Jonah, and so it just becomes three times more expensive to take the podcast on the road. Especially,
we'll drop that dead weight and just go down on your own and have them be on the phone.
Hey, we're doing all right here right now, right? No, I love those jerks.
I know,
but I do. You know, I would love to bring them there, but just the, you know, especially the economics of getting to Australia. It's just like. Well, it's like $5,000 or $6,000 just to get there, and then
it is. You know, and then staying because you can't go for 2 days. Although I know guys who go for 2 days,
fucking
you
crazy.
You really have to put some weeks in when you're there.
Well, yeah, it's 13.5 hours to Sydney, and then just from Sydney, just getting to other, you know, places around there.
Takes forever.
So it's like when you're there, you should be there. I've always wanted to go to New Zealand too. Like dying to go to New Zealand.
You'd love it. I really love New Zealand. My wife doesn't love it quite as much as I do, but I really love it. We were there last year, but I'd been to New Zealand about 5 years, and Australia I'd been to since the 90s, and it had changed so much for the better. It was way less sexist. It was way more worldly. The internet had changed. In 97, I remember having a computer in New Zealand, like that first Mac, you know, that was like the yay big, and you had to put hard disks in it to program it, and like some of them failed when it got programmed, so it always crashed every 2 seconds, and there was no such thing as like an internet, and the big exciting part was faxing on it.
Oh, yes.
Fax using the computer, because you could do that, but you couldn't really do anything. Yeah, 97. And then, of course, now, everything's wired. There's a lot less of, like, I remember there in 97, couldn't get over that a guy would come up and go, "Hey, mate, there's Sheila's eye," like calling women Sheila's and shit, and calling Aborigines Abos.
Yeah.
And like, you're like, I'm not that comfortable with this. I'm from California.
I don't know what your specific racism is, but I can feel that it's coming out right now, and I don't feel comfortable right now.
There was a lot less of it. I mean, I remember working with a Kiwi comic named Mike King, and he was a great big Maori, and he was gorgeous, and so was his wife, you know, and they're from New Zealand. And when they would come on stage, when Mike would come on stage in Oz, the whole crowd, like, you're a sheep fucker.
Oh, but that sucks.
Can you believe that? I mean, like, can you imagine a comic from Alabama stepping on stage in L.A. and everyone in the crowd going, you know what I mean? Like,
actually, I can't imagine that. Yeah.
Well, yes, you can. Well, in Simi Valley. Here's the point. But they kind of stopped doing that. But I remember him saying to me, everywhere I go on stage in this country and I'm introduced as a Kiwi, they bleat when I walk on. And
oh, my God.
He was 6'3" and gorgeous and really funny. And I thought, you have to put up with this shit? You know, like, really? But they kind of, like I say, that's over. And they're a little more evolved. And they're being invaded by China, like, especially Perth. They're really having to deal with the whole international. They're part, you know, I would always call them, say, it's nice to be here in South Asia. And they'd boom, you know. And like, but look where you are. You're here. And
Asia's here.
We're nowhere near you. I know you have white people culture, but frankly, when they go on holiday, they go to Thailand, you know, or Bali or whatever. That's what's close.
I am sad that I've not been to an Asian country yet.
Me neither. I've never been. I'm so woefully. I'm having drinks with a buddy who I'd known from years ago named Russell. And Russell and I are having drinks. And he's telling me about doing corporate gigs. And you know, and you, I don't know how many corporate gigs you do, but I'm sure you've done them.
I have. I don't do a lot of them. They're weird.
They're weird, and they're always uncomfortable.
Now I feel like if I were to do it, it would have to be a tremendous amount of money to offset
right. The
sort of awkwardness.
But aren't you able to put together, like, your own type of corporate gigs? Like, you know, like Comic-Con is in essence...
Like I guess it's a trade show. Yeah. You know what? Comic-Con's like a trade show.
Right into the
I just meant,
mix.
Listen, if it were a corporate gig in a sphere that I understood, right. Like if it was a video game company or a, you know, or a software company or, you know, then I would be fine. But if it was like, you know, Mutual of Omaha.
Right. IBM presents Chris Hardwick.
We're having our annual sales convention. Yeah. You know, then I feel a little less comfortable in those situations.
Horrible. I mean, they're not. Some are good, but we're sitting there drinking and talking, and he goes, I had to go do this corporate gig. We're doing improv, and I'm like, well, where was it? And he's like, Ho Chi Minh City. And I'm like, I have to go to, you know, Cleveland to do the corporate. I like was just bumming, like, but when I do a corporate gig, it's in Tampa. I want to go to Bali for my corporate gig. But you know, it's the same thing. When they get there, it's a bunch of drunk Aussie corporate people.
Yeah.
You know, it's no funner. It's just that the location is, like, you go, fuck me, you got to go to Vietnam?
Yeah.
It just sounds so romantic, but I'm sure he's thinking, you got to go to Tampa?
Yeah. Well, maybe not.
No, maybe not. I overemphasize that one.
But I do think, you know, I'm sure there's some parts of it, you know, where they go, oh, you live so close to South America. You must love to just pop down to Brazil all the time. You're like, no, we don't.
Mexico City. You must be there every week.
No, we're just, unfortunately, we're pretty America-centric here.
I am, and I'm Euro-centric. I mean, I go to Europe way more than I'd like to add Australia and New Zealand way more, but like you say, it's a logistical thing. And England is much easier to get to, and I've got more connections, frankly, to go over there all the time.
Man, if I lived in New York, I'd go to Europe all the time.
Well, isn't that the truth?
Five, six, 7 hours, you're there.
I was just in Philly, and a guy was like, I flew to London with my wife, and we really loved it. I'm like, I would be there, like, every weekend, because it's a 7-hour flight from there. It's 11 bloody hours from here. It takes forever.
And again, you know, it's that planning of, like, well, you can't just go for a day, because your whole first day and a half is travel, and then there's, like, 2 days adjusting to the time difference, and then it's like, okay, now I have 4 or 5 days. Now I have to get 2 days back, you know, and then adjust again for another week. It's just such a commitment.
I did go over once for one day. I have been across the puddle for one day and come right back, but it's not a great idea.
No.
I had to do a gig once and went over for like, a, you know, 36 hours or whatever and boom. And I've come over here for one day and come back to England before.
Oh, to
from
LA?
London, yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
Because I had a gig and I had to do it, but it was like, that is not ideal. Frankly, when you're there, and I don't know how you are when you're traveling, I mean, I have to travel so much, and sometimes I get really sick of it, and I want to come home and just lay there. But I generally love it. But if I'm in England or Europe, I'm not desperate to come home.
Right.
Like, I'm not like after 2 weeks. Do you remember when the Friends went to England in the 90s on their TV show? Like, the TV show Friends,
there
was like a subplot where they went to England and they introduced an English character and all this shit. And I remember them going on the show, I'm homesick. After like a week in England, I was like, you live in New York. Homesick for what? You know what I mean? New York's going to be there. Surely after 2 weeks in London, you're not like, fuck, I got to get home.
Well, I wouldn't go to London now because of the Olympics, because it's probably clusterfuck of, I mean, I was just there last December, and even just in,
yes,
even
I saw you there.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I saw you there because you did set list and killed. Yeah. And even just the pre-Olympic buildup of construction and stuff, like you couldn't get anywhere in town.
No.
I mean, it was, if the tube didn't go to it, you were not getting there in any reasonable amount of time.
No, it was going to take an hour and 45 minutes.
Just no, I mean, like the kind of, I mean, we bitch about traffic in the city, but just nonstop all the time congestion around central London that just, there wasn't, there's nowhere to go.
No. And no, it's really, people don't understand, because I'll say that to them. They're like, you know, the traffic's bad in LA. Sometimes it's excruciating. If you're on the 405 or you get caught on a freeway or it's late at night or whatever. Or late at night, you're like, you're coming back from the Irvine Improv and it's 11:30 and you're driving back to LA and there's a traffic jam where the traffic is completely stopped.
Closed off two of the lanes or the five or something.
But London is just, sometimes you literally sit there for 2 hours and go, this sucks balls. I was there 2 weeks ago. I went to do Geek South of the River with some friends of mine. And I got in a cab and the guy goes, it's a bus strike today. So it's madness.
Oh.
I got a ride home. Fortunately, one of my friends had a car, which nobody has in London, but my friend had a car. So he drove me back. But it was just like. You go, so the Olympics, there's a zillion people there. Yesterday, all the athletes arrived, and it was the busiest day at Heathrow ever. And you think, busier than it usually?
Well, and the city is old enough that most of the streets were not really designed for cars.
No, there's no straight lines. There's no straight road anywhere. Like, it's all 1665. It's all plague road, you know, like, it's a curve. This is where we throw the shit from a bucket down on you, and this is where we throw the cattle. Then there'll be, like, a straight road for 2 feet, and then it turns again, and you're like, there's no such thing as a freeway or a grid in the whole bloody island.
It's funny, we were just talking about this on the Nerdist TV show for BBC America, which I might as well plug. We're coming back July 28th. All right. So, but we had did an episode devoted to time travel. And of course the question of, you know, what other time period would you want to live in? And some people go, you know, I'd really love to live in Victorian England. And then you think about like the daily sort of like what that would mean every day. And you're like, you'd survive for a half a day. But just when you said like like throwing buckets of shit out onto the street, I'm like, no clean water, buckets of shit, no refrigeration,
No air conditioning. Rooms are stifling. And you're wearing a collar if you have any money at all, you're wearing a collar that's starched that you've pinned to the back.
Yeah.
You have to put a collar on.
Yeah.
And sometimes cuffs too. And then if they get stained, you have to get rid of them, and that could be insanely uncomfortable. You've always got a hat. Right?
Now,
so you check your hat everywhere you go.
Just because it's me and this podcast, here's a classy question. Which era do you think had the smelliest balls?
I would say probably the Middle Ages or the Renaissance, when people didn't bathe at all.
Right.
And wore the same clothes every day, and there wasn't a lot of shaving or manscaping going on down there. I think in the ancient times, certain cultures were cleaner than others. Like I say, the bathing cultures, you were lucky. The Romans always made fun of the Germans and the French because they're hairy.
Right.
Whenever you see barbarians in Roman friezes and whatnot, you know, the carvings, they're always stepping on them and their horses are crushing them. And they're hairy. Big beards, big hair. And the Romans are all, you know.
Totally.
Even their beards are, you know, totally trimmed and like no hair, no chest hair. Winchester.
Not at all.
So Iggy Pop. They really went with that Iggy Pop feel.
Did they wax? Is that how they?
They used olive oil and razors, and then supposedly the Emperor Augustus, when he was a teenager, when he was shagging older men to make his way forward in the world, used hot walnut shells to depilate his legs.
Really?
Yes.
How does that work? You just rub
them up and down until the
you just burn the hair off?
The hair, yeah.
Oh.
So that you're a smooth young thing.
Oh, wow.
They were way into that. They all were. But when has that changed? We live in Penn State world. Like, it doesn't fucking exist now.
Well, I always kind of toy with the idea of, like, I'll just because I, you know, I'll just shave all the hair off the front of my butt because it's just kind of gross and itchy in the summer. Right. It gets itchy and, you know, but I never feel more like a serial. Like the couple times that I've actually stood in the shower and taken a razor to my chest, I feel like a fucking serial killer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And I'm going around the nipple and just make sure we get everything clean. Must be clean. Hair is dirty.
Later, I'll do 1,000 push-ups. Christian Bale.
I'll do.
Then I use a cleanser. Then I use a post cleanser.
Then I'll get a very specific card stock.
Yeah.
And then give it to my friends.
Oh yeah, the male vanity is a double-edged sword. it's important for men to look and smell good, but there's a certain point where let it go.
Yeah, exactly. I can't get on board. Plucked male eyebrows is always weird to me. It always looks. I know it's cleaner a little bit, but for some reason it just looks off.
That's like a toughie.
Yeah.
The only reason you should pluck it is if you have a huge unibrow.
Yes.
Clear the middle area.
Just make sure there are two of them.
Right, that's it.
But don't start, you know.
No, when you see him shaped. What's that newscaster on Fox? Shepard Fairey? There's a newscaster.
No, Shepard Fairey is the artist who did the.
Shepard, what did I get wrong? What's his name? Shepard Smith. Is on Shepard Fairey's the artist
who did that? Did the old?
Let me just slam someone completely erroneously. You know that Shepard Fairey, the artist who did Obama's thing, he plucks his eyebrows.
Loves to pluck his eyebrows, but one of them's blue and one of them's red, and then his face is gray.
Yeah, there's all these weird tones. These. And he walks around with a logo underneath his chest at all times.
It's pretty. Yes,
Shepard,
we can.
Smith, I think his name is. And it's clear that he's had Botox, like everyone else on TV.
Sure.
And it's clear that he's had, you know, some injectables and maybe some, you know, light spray tanning. But he's also completely plucked them so that you're like, dude, you really, you shouldn't look like, you know, that feminine. I like when women pluck them entirely and then draw them back in.
Now, that's an interesting idea. Well, that's sort of the old, like, I mean, I don't have my mother's mother died when I was probably 5 years old. But what I do remember of her was this kind of 50s, 60s thing that carried over into the 70s for older ladies, which was they just basically took a fucking Sharpie.
Yeah.
And then just wah. Just like one of those, or just a thick, you know, those thick permanent markers that you just open it up, and then you get lightheaded the second it hits the air, and then just fucking draw that comma over their eyeballs, that thick.
Right. And the red lipstick. And
the bright red lipstick. Yeah, and then, you know, it was just like there was like a powdery base underneath where you would just see like kind of light facial hair kind of, you know, just bursting forward a little bit. And then... And then a thick, pungent odor of rose water or something.
The jangly bracelets.
Yep.
And then maybe you're from Kentucky, maybe a chicken with candy in it, a porcelain chicken or whatever.
Oh, yeah. With
little hard candies.
With hard candies or butterscotch or like, yeah.
The little ribbony butterscotch things.
Yep.
And then the fake glass cherries that had a wooden... stem.
Oh yeah, I remember those.
Like a side thing. Like, what? When did that decor?
I don't know.
Take hold.
I think in those days there were really about only 5 or 6 things that people could buy for their houses,
right. And they were all in avocado and goldenrod.
And everyone had them. But now we're international traders.
Oh yeah.
Because of the internet.
Right, you can have an Oriental rug now.
So when the smartest man in the world?
It's on Tuesdays at 8. No, that's right. Todd Glass and I were saying you got to get a better time slot for your podcast.
Your podcast. You got to not follow.
He was joking about it, and I go, "When's yours on?" He's like, "Tuesday at 8." I go, "I got prime time. I'm Wednesday at 9. And I keep my lead in.
We're on Mondays at midnight. Yeah, I can't get this fucking
sucks,
time
man.
Slot.
I'm tired of being on
fucking
FX.
Network, man. Yeah, yeah. Keeping me down. Oh, wait, I'm the network. Oh, shit.
Yeah, oops. I was going to say, you can't say that.
Why do I hate myself?
Mine is on iTunes, and or you can go to proopcast.com or gregproops.com. And I make one every week. It's a weekly show. I don't know when this show's dropping.
I think I might drop this one tomorrow.
Well, then, next week on the 25th, I will be showing Point Break at the Cine Family and doing the podcast around it.
Oh, fantastic.
Interrupt the movie. That's Doug's shtick.
Yeah.
But I'll do a half hour before. We'll show the picture and then we'll have a little discussion after. I did Buckaroo Banzai a month ago, speaking of Nerdist.
Fantastic.
And it was really, I couldn't believe it. It was like a Tuesday night. There was like 150 people there.
Everyone loves Buckaroo Banzai and they never got a sequel.
I didn't know that though. I picked it because I love it. And my wife was like, really? Buckaroo Banzai? Because I don't meet that many women who like the movie. And she's never seen it. I know a few, but not a lot. And God damn it, the place was fucking heaving.
Sure.
And now I found, and this was my mistake. One was to love you, girl. But secondly, my other mistake was I take questions after and people are going, how come there wasn't a scene? You know, now I'm having to be like I was a producer.
They think you're an expert on the film. Yeah. No, no, I'm just.
I just watched it a bunch of times.
Yeah.
I didn't really like.
So, now Point Break.
Yeah, now Point Break. Point Break, I've seen a billion times. I don't care about the producing or anything. And no one's going to ask for a sequel because Bodhi doesn't come back.
Right.
Spoiler alert. But that is amazing fun. I didn't think it. I mean, I asked to do it. And then they gave me a date, and I had no idea it was actually going to work. I thought, like, I really had visions. You know, Chris, when you think you put up a gig and you think, there's going to be fucking 11 people here.
Yeah.
It's going to be me and 10 other sad people, and we're going to have to do this anyway.
I always think that.
I always think that.
I always think that. I always say to my girlfriend, and I'm never fishing, and I'm not, I mean it sincerely, like, we're doing this podcast, this thing. No one's going to show up. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what. Right. And then, you know, and then
hundreds of people there.
And then people show up and then I feel okay. But it never, I still never,
you're talking about.
I never get used to the idea. I'm always like, no one's going to fucking show up to this thing.
Me neither. Well, I mean, my wife said it to me the other day, why don't you take a day off? And I'm like, because if I don't work, that's the end.
Yeah, exactly. If
I will be stricken from the rules of show business.
I'll tell you what it is. I was like, all of us, like, I think a lot of us who have the podcast and are building out all these different things, it's like, we're all the plot of Speed. Like, I cannot go below 55 miles an hour. If this bus stops, it fucking blows up.
This will blow up on me. If I don't put one out for 1 week, that's the end of
the goddamn
world.
It's over. Everyone's going to unsubscribe. I'll never work again.
You suck. I couldn't believe when I started it that, like, I was doing it twice a month. I thought, well, surely no one will want more than that. And then it was like, where's the new one?
Right.
And then I didn't quite get it regular for the first couple of months. And it was like, it would come out on a Tuesday, or, you know.
Yeah.
And then they'd be like, where's the fucking new one?
Yeah.
Like, you listen to an hour and a half of blather and still want more? So now we put it out on a regular basis on Fridays.
Excellent.
But, yeah, it's been the funnest thing I've ever done. And I say that with all sincerity. I've done stand-up, I've done improv, I've done a million things, and the fucking podcast is...
Well, yeah, because it's all you. You take full responsibility and ownership over it, and it's... You literally just get to be... Even if you're on stage and you're still saying, like, well, I'm going to do what I want to do, there's still a certain amount of give and take that you have to have with the audience because it's a relationship. But on your podcast, you're just you.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like people can either take that or leave it. And so, you know, when people say to me online, like, you should do more of this or you shouldn't do as much of that. And I'm like, don't listen. I'm not going to change. This is what I want to do. And it makes me happy.
Yeah.
And you're not paying for it. So,
right.
You know, like, you know, I mean, I hope you like it. But if you don't, I can't do anything about that.
I'm not going to add more about the Hulk every week just because you like that. But that's what people want.
Oh, I should
do
that,
though. You should talk more about these things. And you're like, no. I'm going to talk about what I like to talk about.
Because it's my...
Because it's free, why don't you fast forward right to the end and see if you find something you like. Well, I will say during the middle of mine, flip over to Dana Gould.
Right.
You're not going to like this part. Or, you know, flip. I'll just name any other podcaster, you know. Flip over to Jimmy Pardo. You'll find his more interesting during the next 20 minutes of my show.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on again, Greg Proops. You were on one of our earlier podcasts.
I guess it was a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it was in the beginning. You were on in the beginning.
Really?
You were probably within the first 20 episodes, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
How exciting. Well, thank you for having me back.
Great. It's good. It's good to see you again.
I miss the boys, but say hi to them.
I will say hi. Jonah's getting his wisdom teeth out.
How old is he?
Almost 30.
Oh my, that's gonna hurt.
So, and then poor Matt Myra got the nerd flu at Comic-Con, so he's down for
from
the count.
From touching people?
From touching people. You know, I find it's always best to just take your finger and then just take a swath of sweat off the side of their face and then just rub it into your eyeball.
Oh. Can I ask you one Comic-Con related question?
Yeah, sure.
Here's my first one.
Yes.
Are hot chicks infiltrating Comic-Con wearing funny outfits, doing cosplay outfits, just because they know that it'll be popular? Or are there legitimately hot chicks going there wearing, like, Wonder Woman outfits?
A little from column A, a little from column B. But here's what I think happened. I think those of us who are old enough to remember when nerd culture was a very specific section of people, mm-hmm. of early adopters who had to seek it out when it was not popular and suffered for that, I think, there's a certain degree of, like, you know, oh, those attractive people can't really be into this shit because nerds are this very specific.
Yeah.
But what we found is that because nerd culture in the last, you know, let's say 10, 15 years has become so ubiquitous and has become such an integral part of pop culture, you find that a lot of people of all walks of life just happened to – it was available to them. And, you know, maybe there were people who were awkward when they were younger that maybe grew into,
right.
you know, they became more physically attractive or whatever. But whether or not they were attractive as kids or not, the fact is that so much of this is acceptable now,
right.
that kids who've grown up in the last 10 years are just people, you know, like everyone. You know, like I think our sort of 80s archetypal structure is not entirely accurate anymore.
Right. Although I keep reading all the jokes about it. It's always the same. It's a bunch of fat guys who don't bathe and.
Yeah. Which is because that's how mainstream media still represents nerd culture. And yeah, okay, sure. Yes, there are fat people who like nerdy things. There are skinny people who like nerdy things. There are attractive people. There are jocks who like nerdy. Like, it's become so much a part of the culture now that, you know, that there are definitely some people who are exploiting it. There are definitely some people who are like, here's where the money is. I'm going to put on this outfit and go take advantage of it. But there are also just genuinely, you know, what you said exists. There are people from all walks of life who are into it. Comic-Con this year was fucking amazing. I don't know, you know, it was more crowded than I've ever seen it, but just the energy was really, really good this year.
Nice.
Yeah, so it was really fun.
I went to one in 80.
Wow.
In San Francisco, yeah.
Well, that was a true comics con.
Oh, yeah. We performed and I was in a comedy group and we did a parody of Empire Strikes Back.
Oh, wow.
And, And I was Luke Skyscraper or some awful goddamn shit, you know. And that was like the real deal as far as there were people selling comic books.
Mm-hmm.
There was people selling movie memorabilia, but it was real small. It was in San Francisco at this little venue and shit like that. And, you know, just to see it blow up to be like this national. Here's my second question, which is completely self-serving.
Sure.
I was in The Phantom Menace. I'm in a new movie called The Hell and Back. I was in Nightmare Before Christmas. Do I have enough Comic-Con credentials to go down there as an entity and appear?
Yes, you do, because you have, these comics, like the bigger Comic-Cons have become just sort of like media cons.
Right.
And so for a lot of people who grew up, you know, or who were adults, who remember you from Who's Line, then you're going to have a section of those people. You're going to have a section of people that love you for the podcast. You're going to have a section of people that love your stand up. You're going to have a section of people that recognize you as the announcer from the pod races, you know?
Yeah.
So you're going to have like five or six really significant things that I think are going to draw people out to see you. I think you should do it. I think you should absolutely do it.
And you
can experiment. If you don't want to go straight to the juggernaut of San Diego Comic-Con, there are smaller ones you could hit that I think you'd enjoy, like Emerald City or Phoenix Comic-Con or New York Comic-Con or C2E2 in Chicago or actually Star Wars Celebration would be good for you in Orlando because you are in one of the films.
Yeah. So I used to get offers, but they're always from creepy dudes that put a lot of exclamation points in their emails. and I always thought, do I want to whore up that bad?
I'll tell you which ones to go to. And you know, you can... And a lot of times, by the way, we are doing live podcasts of these things, so you could just come be a guest on our show if you want to also have something to do, or you could do your own podcast. I mean, I think there's enough. I think you have enough cred in this world, especially as sort of. British influenced and academic as you are,
I think I'd been on a Doctor Who.
Oh man, one episode.
I know.
I mean, there are people who will go and sign stuff that were, you know, on one famous episode of one show. Absolutely.
See, that's what I was always wondering. I mean, I have a few things that I know people, comic people like, you know, Nightmare Before Christmas and shit like that. I don't have any huge parts in anything, but I'm in them.
Yeah.
And I thought. But I've just never bothered to go. Like I say, every time I get the emails with 5 exclamation points, I panic.
I still think the podcast would be, would be your biggest draw. It's just that's just the way it is. That's just the way it is now. Like our podcasts are really the anchors of why people are familiar with us. Because a comic's job is to get their voice into the world as much as possible, and since that's not as available on television anymore, it is that the podcast has become our. Survival mechanism. We, like rats, we have gone from the one sinking ship and burrowed into some other place to try to thrive.
Is that the truth?
And it's working and we're thriving. And so it's really, we've managed to squeeze into this whole new medium that never existed before. It's a really fun, interesting time to be a comedian.
I agree.
And a time that is not just about how do you get on stage and tell jokes, but how do you innovate being able to do that? And so for me, it's really a fun time. Greg Proops at Greg Proops on Twitter and all the other things you said.
Yeah,
Greg
Proops. Come and visit me. Download me for free.
Yes, the smartest man in the world on iTunes. This is Chris Hardwick signing off here on the Nerdist Podcast. Sorry, Matt and Jonah couldn't be here, but. Y'all stay safe out there in podcast land. This is the most radio-ish way that I've ever ended the podcast.
So long, everybody. This is your old pal Greg Proops saying goodbye from Hollywood.
Goodbye, and enjoy your burritos. Marching into the future, the Nerdist Podcast.
Now the camera turns to the world of entertainment. At Comic-Con, there's a lot of cosplay going on. Watch out with those lightsabers. Boing.
Old man Hitler wouldn't dare to tread on these grounds.
We always used to do an English report and start a radio show. Here's one in the eye for you, Mr. Hitler, and off we go.
Looks like you could use a shave, Mr. Hitler.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Comixology, with an X. Comixology is the world's largest digital comic store with over 25,000 comic books. Go to comixology.com/redeem, enter hashtag Spider-Man or hashtag AVX to get 2 free comics.
What came first, the chicken or the egg? Spoiler alert, it's neither. At Happy Egg, we believe happiness of the hens is what actually came first. Because without happy hens, there would be no such thing as happy eggs. You know, eggs with delicious orange yolks. Those come from hens who are raised the happy way on 8+ acres of family-owned farms. Choose happy at happyegg.com and look for the yellow carton at a store near you.
Happy Egg.